The third case for oral argument this morning is Arrowhead Ridge 1, Appellant versus Coldstone Creamery, Inc., Appley. For the appellant, we have Mr. Timothy, is it Grand or Grandy?
Grand,
attorney from Minneapolis, and Mr. Sam Asson, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Grand, you'll be presenting this morning. Yeah, very well. And for the Appley, we have Mr. Stephen Sanford, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Grand, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes. Thank you again for, we all thank you again for agreeing to hear our case today. This is an action over a lease, as you already know. You hear a lot of cases. I'm going to try to keep this generic. I'll try to refer to the landlord as the landlord, the tenant as the tenant. Maybe that might help rather than names, because those get kind of confusing. I represent the landlord, Arrowhead. Mr. Sanford represents the lessee, Cold Spring, in this action. The lease that's at issue in this case, and this is a breach of lease case and a remedies case, the breach of lease that is involved in this case is at Arrowhead's appendix at A66 to A100. If you pick that lease up at first blush and look at it without any background, you're going to see some unusual things about that lease. One of the most unusual things is that that tenant on the lease, Coldstone, who agrees to a 10-year lease in the first two pages of the lease, also signs as the guarantor at the end of the lease. That's one unusual thing you'll find about that lease. Another thing you'll find is that the tenant, Coldstone, who agrees to the 10-year lease in the first couple of pages in the body of the lease, also has a limitation of damages clause in that lease. It's unusual, and it would tend for somebody to say at first blush, who drafted this thing? So I'd like to take a few minutes of my precious time and explain how they got there, because it was not a lessor issue on how this lease resulted as it did, but it was the product of negotiations. And again, I'll stay only with the pertinent facts, but this involves a small strip mall in Sioux Falls for a handful of tenants in a growing area in Sioux Falls, and as Arrowhead, the landlord, was putting together its package to build this strip mall and put together its financing, it was seeking tenants. Coldstone came to Arrowhead by way of a letter of intent initially, showing strong interest to lease in this strip mall. It sent over, Coldstone did, a letter of intent which identified, I'll stick to the pertinent clauses, it identified as the tenant, Coldstone Leasing, an entity with no assets and no liabilities. And then it had the rest of the terms that it wanted in its lease. But initially it identified the tenant as Coldstone Leasing, an entity with no assets and liabilities, to which Arrowhead said, you know, we're trying to get our financing together. We need a tenant who's good for 10 years on this premises. They have to assume it's not going to, you know, to protect yourself, you have to assume it's going to fail. Arrowhead said they needed a tenant who could pay this thing for 10 years if the lease went bad. An entity with no assets just isn't going to do it. So it was clear that Coldstone was very serious about entering this lease and coming into this strip mall. So the parties went directly from the letter of intent and got right into the lease document itself and started trading documents. The first lease that went out from Arrowhead to Coldstone, Arrowhead replaced Coldstone, the entity with no assets, with Coldstone, the actual franchisor from Arizona, who had assets, because Arrowhead was comfortable with their credit and they'd agreed to their credit for 10 years and said so to Coldstone. So the first draft of the lease went out with Coldstone, the entity with assets on it, and Coldstone got that. They came back and said, you know, we're a franchisor, and really the party that's going to be on this lease is going to be the franchisee, which is a couple called the Reismans in town. And to which Arrowhead responded, well, okay, you know, we'll contract with the tenant, but you, the franchisor, are going to have to guarantee that lease. Coldstone came back and said, you know, we'll give you a limited guarantee for 12 months after a default. but nothing more. And at that point, Arrowhead, this is kind of the final act, Arrowhead said, here's what we'll do. I will agree to your Coldstone's limitation of liability on this deal, but only if I see the tenant's financials and they're good for us. In other words, if they can prove that they can make payments on this, if this thing goes under, then I'm okay, and then I'll agree to limitation of liability. The last draft went out with the guarantee and the limitation of damages provision in it, because that's what they were talking about, but Arrowhead would not take the good Coldstone entity off as a tenant until they could prove that the franchisee had the wherewithal to do this. Because otherwise you'd have a document out there which is an offer, and that's not what Arrowhead was agreeable to do. Nothing happened. And Arrowhead never got the Reisman's financials, the franchisees, so nothing happened for about 5 or 6 weeks in the summer of 2004, until at the end of the summer, Arrowhead got a call from Coldstone saying, you know what, you don't need the Reisman's, the franchisees' financials, we're going corporate on this, Coldstone's taking this themselves, don't worry about it, to which Arrowhead said, fine, looks good to us. So before Arrowhead could actually get a revised lease out the door, though, in overnight mail came 3 signed leases by Coldstone, where they executed the lease both as the lessee and they signed the guarantee provision, to which Arrowhead said, well, you know, I just got off the phone with these guys. They said it's a corporate lease. It's a 10-year deal. Therefore, we're okay with this. This expresses the intent that we wanted. So the point of all that is that the lease got into its shape, not because of anything the lessor did, it was because the lessee signed a draft and sent it back. Now we'll get to the issue that we're up on appeal on, the main issue, which is the mitigation issue. There's a default 2 years into the 10-year lease, and we went to court on the default. Arrowhead proved up its damages against Coldstone, and in part, and in his case in chief, Arrowhead put in evidence of its efforts to mitigate its damages in this case. And Arrowhead's witness testified that he talked to Cigar Lounge, he talked to several people who wanted to do a Cigar Lounge, a beauty parlor, a tanning place, he talked to Juice Stop, he talked to Jimmy John's, he talked to Subway, Great Clips. And finally, Reliabank came along and wanted to put a bank in that space and even a little more space in the mall. So he actually negotiated with a lease with Reliabank where they agreed to all the terms. They agreed to the amount, the term, and everything else. The only thing Reliabank needed, and both parties signed it, the only thing Reliabank needed was regulatory approval. So there was a contingency in the lease on a regulatory approval, and which Reliabank didn't get, and that fell through. During all of that testimony, some testimony came out that one of the leases in the strip mall with Huhat, one of those leases had an exclusivity provision which restricted the landlord from putting in another restaurant that sold Asian food or sold buffet-style food. And as this court knows, at the end of the day, Judge Caldwell ruled that Arrowhead was not able to release this place for various reasons. But Judge Caldwell found plaintiff's inability to relet the premises in this case is due solely to plaintiff's contractual agreement with another tenant. In other words, Judge Caldwell found that actually considered none of the other evidence with respect to releasing, but basically said that this exclusivity provision itself prevented Arrowhead from mitigating its damages. In other words, she said an exclusivity provision which takes out of the potential lease market, 1-2% of the potential tenants, which might be Asian food restaurants or buffet-style restaurants, but leaves open the remaining 98%, taking out that one little percentage and perhaps the one tenant that might lease because of that, prohibits now the landlord from proving up mitigation of his damages. Kind of ignores the fact that there are 97% or 8% of possible tenants out there which can be leased, and in fact was shown to in the list of tenants in which they did engage with negotiations. So that is where Arrowhead thinks the error occurred. Arrowhead thinks that the standard set forth in the Ducharme case, which basically says that the duty to mitigate upon the landlord requires reasonable exertion to render injury as light as possible. We think that Judge Caldwell should have considered all of the efforts taken by the landlord to release his premises, including the ReliaBank, where they actually got to a signed lease, to determine if the standard in the Ducharme case was actually met. Now, I'm butchering the name or the description of that case. I'm sure I'm describing it wrong, but it's cited in the brief. So that's the principal error that we're up here on, and we think that the relief would be that this case should probably go back for determination or at least an instruction that the court has to look at all of the landlord's efforts to mitigate its damages and get another tenant in there and not rely solely on one clause which carves out possibly one tenant. Because the effect that has with that hoo-ha restriction in there is any tenant who defaults in that strip mall can say, well, wait a minute, your hoo-ha lease says you can't essentially now lease to Chinese restaurants. You can't mitigate your damages. Therefore, it renders all of the remedies sections and all of the other leases unenforceable. That's an issue. I mean, that's kind of a problem, Arrowhead thinks, and thinks that it can correct it if the judge is asked to consider all of that evidence. The other fact that it kind of ignores is the fact that exclusivity provisions in leases, as evidenced by the leases in this strip mall, are common. They're actually often required by tenants, and in fact, Cold Stone itself has an exclusivity provision in its lease. The fact is that you're not going to be able to lease to a Subway in a small strip mall like this, if the landlord retains the right to put a Jimmy John's right next to you. Subway's going to want an exclusive. They're not going to want to put them both together. So, frankly, the existence of an exclusivity clause in a lease and the landlord's willingness to entertain exclusivity clauses is actually a positive thing for tenants, and is actually it actually enhances the landlord's ability to mitigate his damages. So to hold that the existence of that clause in one lease negates the ability to mitigate your damages makes really no sense, and it's something we Arrowhead thinks can be corrected. Now, the actual effort that Arrowhead did expend in trying to release this premises demonstrates what Arrowhead feels was the desperation, but the efforts of a landlord who has went out and got funding to build this strip mall, funding to build the build-outs for the Cold Stone space based upon the good credit of a tenant for 10 years who stopped paying rent after about 2.5 years. What it leaves is the landlord's payment of his development loan in putting that. And the efforts he did go to relet the premises, we think, belie that true intent, as he's out there trying to cover his own a liability, and so mitigation is in the landlord's interest also because no rent was being paid. The only other issue we're coming up on appeal on today is the attorney's fee issue, and there's both a statutory and a contractual argument with respect to the attorney's fee issue. The statutory argument I'll talk about first because it does bring up some interesting concepts with respect to states that have actually adopted unlawful detainer statutes, such as South Dakota. Judge Caldwell ruled that, well, you know, you really didn't have to bring an unlawful detainer action in this matter, so I'm not going to award you attorney's fees under the unlawful detainer statute. So the first question kind of becomes, was it necessary to bring an unlawful detainer action in this case? We didn't find any South Dakota law on point. But we did look around the United States to see what states have adopted unlawful detainer statutes to see what they've done. And in those states and in those cases cited in the brief, you'll find that almost uniformly those cases will state, you know, the unlawful detainer remedy we're going to hold is the exclusive remedy in this state to recover property or to recover your possession rights in that property just on public policy grounds. What it negated, if you read those cases, is the remedy of self-help. I mean, what you had in those days, what you had was you have landlords who have in their leases self-help clauses that say, you know, if you breach your lease, we can go back in and lock the doors and throw you out. And the states which have adopted these statutes have said, you know what, self-help is no good. It's led to too many problems. Too many landlords going in at midnight, changing the locks, and dispossessing their tenants to their harm. You've got an unlawful detainer statute. It's cheap. It's quick. It's fast. We're going to make that the exclusive remedy in this state for that, in many of those states that have those unlawful detainer.
In your claim, for attorney's fees, did you apportion the amount that you were going to, that you expended just for the lawful detainer action, as opposed to your claim for back rent and so forth?
Did you? No. And in fact, Your Honor, there were none of the attorney's fees that were claimed were for the unlawful detainer portion. And Judge Caldwell brought that up. So
how is it even relevant that these other cases are even relevant if you're not claiming any attorney's fees for the unlawful detainer action?
Well, it's through the statute itself, Your Honor. The unlawful detainer statute provides at 21-16-4 states that the statute allows for an action for damages for rents and profits in an unlawful detainer action, although the landlord is permitted to pursue those in another venue if it wishes to do so. So the statute itself says, you know, if you want to, you can bring your action for rents and damages, although if you want to, you can also bring those in another action. And then the statute 21-16-11 awards attorney's fees for in unlawful detainer actions. Now, Judge Caldwell ruled when she brought up that point, she basically said, well, she basically implies, I'll give you attorney's fees for the unlawful detainer portion, but I'm not going to give you attorney's fees for the, you know, for going after the damages. You know, I'm probably saying that's governed by your lease or whatever, da-da-da-da-da. And Arrowhead, respectfully, doesn't think the statute makes that distinction. The statute says you get attorney's fees for unlawful detainer actions. Now, if the statute makes that distinction, this court can so rule. Arrowhead respectfully thinks it doesn't make that distinction, so on that basis, it would make the claim. Now, to finish off the prior point, I was getting to the point where the unlawful detainer statutes were initially enacted and made exclusive to get rid of the self-help claim. That's not really what we have here. Judge, and Coldstone will stay at it, and Judge Caldwell made it part of a ruling. This isn't a self-help deal. Coldstone gave up the property. They abandoned it. I mean, basically, this is an abandonment issue. So this really isn't your self-help thing. You can just go back in and walk in and take the premises. Well, enter the Simpson case, which is also cited in our brief, which comes out of the District of Columbia, where a landlord did just, well, first of all, people who violate these things and do a self-help thing, they're getting sued. They're getting hit for punitive damages if they make the wrong decision on any of this stuff. In Simpson, in the District of Columbia, the landlord came in and said, you know, I'm getting sued here, but the tenant abandoned the property. So I had a right to go back in under an abandonment theory. The court said, you know, we kind of disagree. There's some evidence that the tenant still thought it may have rights, maybe rights to release the premises or not. And so we're going to hold, you know, you're wrong in your abandonment call and ding Simpson for damages and that thing. So now the landlord's in a position where if you think there's an abandonment, you've got to make a judgment call yourself. Well, and that puts the landlord at danger in the abandonment era, just as it did in the self-help era. So I guess it's Arrowhead's position is there's an unlawful detainer statute out there which is cheap, it's fast, it's quick. If it wants to eliminate the risk that some court's going to come down and say, you made the abandonment call wrong, this isn't really an abandonment. The landlord has the right to use the unlawful detainer statute to get that order that says, you know what, this guy, by law, doesn't have any possessory rights anymore into this property. So we think that's a benefit for the landlord and a right the landlord has under the statute. If he doesn't want to run the risk of a tenant coming after him for damages and hitting him for abandonment, or if he makes the call wrong, it's a simple, cheap remedy. It's safe for the landlord. It's prudent. So that's our position on the statutory thing. quickly on the contractual argument, because I'm done in about a minute. The difference in the clause in this case is, were the American rule, costs and expenses don't equal attorney's fees. Admitted. No questions. All the law says that, all kinds of cases. The Cracker Barrel case cited by a Coldstone says that. This clause is different. This clause has costs and expenses in it, which we know doesn't include attorney's fees, and it goes further, and it says, now I don't have it in front of me, it basically says the landlord can recover all expenses, all sums incurred as a result of the breach. So it's something beyond cost expenses, because that's in there, which doesn't include attorney's fees, but it's all sums. Now, 6 seconds. If the court finds that's ambiguous, you have the testimony of the only witness for Arrowhead, who basically said, thanks. Well, time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel. Mr. Sanford, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Before I get into my argument, I want to point out one omission that's undisputed, made by counsel for the landlord in describing the process by which this unusual is one word, I would say bizarre non-contract got made, and that is it's undisputed that in July 2004, while this was negotiation was going on, by the way, this whole transaction was negotiated between brokers. The parties themselves never talked, ever. One broker said to the other on, I think, July 12, it's Exhibit X, that Sam, Mr. Assen, has agreed to the 18-month limitation of liability and will accept Coldstone as the guarantor. And the significance of that is that an earlier discussion had talked about 1 year, but in July, before the lease was signed, it was communicated to Coldstone through Arrowhead's, the landlord's broker and Coldstone's broker, that this 18-month limited liability provision would be accepted, and that the landlord would then provide the revision that got that done. Well, what happened was, and you can tell from Exhibit 2, that the 18-month limited liability as prepared by the landlord crossed out tenant and left in guarantor. And so that draft is what got signed, and it was quite frankly not caught by the Coldstone broker, and so it presented the anomaly that the tenant and the guarantor are the same party, but contrary to the expressed intent in the email, wearing one hat, it was 10 years, and wearing another hat, it was 18 months. And, of course, the two are completely repugnant and caused by, in this case, the landlord. And that's not the only problem here. In fact, I think this is really kind of a law school example about how not to form a contract and how a contract between, unfortunately, sophisticated parties who don't talk to each other, how a contract can't quite get formed. Counsel described this contract as unusual. Well, the form, the contract itself, comes from a variety of forms cobbled together by the landlord and containing a number of very bizarre provisions. Number one, it provides the Iowa law applies. And Mr. Assam agreed that's his mistake. The property's in South Dakota. Coldstone doesn't have any connection to Iowa. Iowa has nothing to do with this. The second problem created by the landlord was that the lease provided two different interest rates on default. Both set on default. One provision says you pay one thing. One provision says you pay entirely another. Neither party, acting, not talking to each other, acting solely through brokers, both missed it. Mr. Assam agrees that it was his mistake and was his fault. And, of course, that brings us to the final most fundamental problem is that the same party was said to have two different durations of liability. Again, caused by the landlord. So that brings us to what I think is the fundamental question in this appeal, and that is where two parties don't talk to each other, function only through intermediaries who really don't talk to each other very well, and when a purported contract contains a variety of different exactly opposite provisions on material points, can it be said under South Dakota law that, in fact, the two parties' minds met in the same way on every material provision? If not, there is no contract. And that is the principal point I come to the court with today. Because if the court says these riddled mistakes and misunderstandings can be the basis for a contract, it is very hard to imagine a set of facts under which a contract could not be formed. These companies were ships passing in the night and had no agreement on several key points, being interest rate. But the duration of liability is the one that is the most problematic for contract formation purposes. The Reed v. McKinnon Hospital case is really Exhibit A in terms of what the law is in South Dakota. In that case, McKinnon Hospital excluded a doctor from who had left Medical X-Ray Center on the premise that there was an exclusive contract between the parties, between Medical X-Ray and the hospital, as were permitted by the bylaws. But in fact, after the doctor was excluded, the MXC, Medical X-Ray Center, said, nah, we're afraid of an exclusive contract. This court held that the hospital and Medical X-Ray did not have a meeting of the minds on all essential points.
What did Colstone offer the judge on the meeting of the minds as to that limited liability?
Pardon? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm assuming there was some evidence presented on whether or not the meeting of the minds on the limited liability. What did Colstone offer at the trial court level?
Colstone offered two things. Number one, it universally does not agree to assume responsibility under a lease that's going to be assumed or operated by a franchisee without a limitation of liability. And second, they offered documents prepared at the time of the lease was formed, summarizing the lease and expressing their intent and understanding as to what the arrangement was. Both of them were admitted into evidence. Both suggested, reported that they, from their perspective, they thought they had an 18-month rolling limitation of liability. There was no dispute about what they thought.
But Judge Caldwell found there was a contract.
Yes, yes.
So you're claiming that it's a mistake of fact or a mistake of law?
First of all, her finding?
Yes.
The cases of this court, her interpretation of a contract is reviewed de novo. In this case, her viewing this as actually forming a contract, in this case, the facts are really undisputed. I mean, there's no dispute as to what Holstone was told would be the 18-month limit of liability. There's no dispute as to who wrote the lease and created the conflict, and there is no dispute at all as the fact that Coldstone's internal documents do present their side the understanding that they thought they had an 18-month limited liability. The essentials of this are really undisputed. The contract just does not stand up. It contains repugnant clause after repugnant clause. Particularly, I mean, on just the interest rate issue, the tri-state ethanol, the First Dakota National Bank Eighth Circuit case, under very similar facts, where a bank had a one type of prepayment penalty at one percentage, and the same document had another. The Court of Appeals ruled that that had to be construed against the bank that promoted it.
I guess I'm going to ask you this again. Was there any testimony that Coldstone presented to the? It was a part of the problem when I'm reading the trial court's findings here. That there was no testimony presented. Therefore, these documents that you're referencing lack foundation, and she didn't consider them. Is that right?
We had a long discussion in the record about what they were. We established the foundation, and Jill Silverberg, who is the custodian of the documents, testified to what they were, and they were admitted. They were admitted into evidence, I frankly didn't understand Judge Caldwell's then saying that there was nothing presented about it, because clearly. We had a debate on the record. There's testimony as to what they were, and they were admitted. They're offered. There was an objection made, and she overruled the objection and admitted the documents. And there's no dispute about what they were and what they said, and there was no dispute that how they were prepared and why they were prepared. I don't have any explanation as to why she then said, I'm not going to pay attention to them, because they clearly were testified to by the custodian as to what they were. They were identified. The date was established. We believe that even on a deferential review, I mean, the statement that somehow they don't exist, is clearly erroneous, and even aside from that, the fact that this has two opposite provisions on three key points, all generated by the landlord, in and of itself, in terms of how did these parties have a mind that met on according to the precedent of this court, pretty hard to fathom. Just going to some of the other issues, the interest rate issue, I think, is covered by the tri-state ethanol case, which says that when you have two opposite provisions on the same provision, the author of that document suffers the ambiguity being resolved against them. Contrary to what the reply brief said, it was clearly decided under South Dakota contract law and not under bankruptcy law.
You're disputing then, or was the evidence disputed that there wasn't drafts that went back and forth?
There were drafts that went back and forth containing this error, and nobody caught it. I mean, it was looked at by two brokers, and
it wasn't a pre-form lease that, like you would think, landlord, tenant, and the tenant had to sign it or forget about it. That really isn't the case here. There was actually some negotiations back.
Not on that point. In fact, that error was even carried through in the Reliant Bank lease that they're talking about. It was put in there at the beginning by the mistake of the landlord, and neither Neither party even looked at it until this lawsuit started. And again, this is really an example of how not to make a contract, unfortunately.
Even though the parties, though, when you look at it, every page here, both the landlord and the tenant date it and sign it.
No question.
So it's sort of like, who do we let off of this? If everybody looked at it and signed it, and now you're saying, well, we shouldn't have to follow this, even though we looked at it and signed it.
Well, then okay, what do you follow? Which provision of the two put in by the landlord does the landlord get the benefit of when the landlord created the problem?
One would think then you would take testimony, because obviously that creates an ambiguity.
You see, the problem is...
That's why back to my question.
Yeah. Well, here...
Did the court then take testimony on what was truly intended and what was the meeting of the minds on that issue?
There was no meeting of the minds because no one... I mean, there couldn't be any meeting of the minds because no one thought about it until the franchisee, the tenant, left. Nobody even knew... quite frankly, the parties paid so little attention to this lease that the drafter of it didn't know it was there. No party individual who signed it knew it was there. It simply was not brought out at all until there was a dispute. And so there was no intent. Gee whiz, I got two interest rates in there, but I only mean one of them.
All right. Mr. Sanford, you're running out of time. I understand you're saying there isn't any lease, but what about the mitigation issue? That's the other issue in this case. What's your position on that?
Two things. First of all, in the normal situation, the party asserting the failure to mitigate has the burden of proof that damages were not mitigated. This lease document flips that entirely. And it says not just that the landlord shall have an obligation to exercise reasonable care to mitigate damages. It flat says the landlord shall mitigate its damages. It's the first paragraph of Section 31. So it imposes upon the landlord the obligation to mitigate damages.
Okay, so the fact that there's an exclusivity clause in another lease, are you saying that in and of itself proves that there was not mitigation?
Here's what happened, and Mr. Assam testified that this would have been leased very shortly after the franchisee vacated the premises. Would have been leased to Chi Chi's Pizza for the full listing price, except that the landlord agreed to a very, very broad not exclusivity provision with an adjoining tenant, not just to serve that type of food, but not to serve a broad variety of things. That prevented this lease space from being filled. And it's our view that where a landlord voluntarily so ties his hands with the lease space that he cannot lease it to a logical new tenant, he has not fulfilled that contractual duty, which goes far beyond what our law imposes absent a contractual provision, he has the affirmative duty to mitigate damages. Now, a party thinking about that, a landlord thinking about that, could write a contract to say that, okay, we do have a duty to mitigate, but... our honoring an obligation to another tenant will not, in fact, impair our ability to recover. But the landlord chose not to put that in the lease. It isn't there. All it says is this very broad statement that the landlord shall mitigate its damages and to agree with some other party for some other party's benefit to a extraordinarily broad exclusivity provision that, in fact, not hypothetically prevents the property from being leased, but actually, in this case, by undisputed fact, prevented this from being leased. We believe that under the very broad contractual provision that the landlord, having the burden to mitigate damages, failed to prove that it did. And I think the court also said, as a practical matter, this is one of the busiest intersections in the city, growing intersections at the corner of New Highway 100, SD 100, and Highway 42, across from Target and Walmart, and as an outlot to Menards, 2 years is enough, enough is enough. So on that basis, while I've not addressed everything in my brief, decisions on attorney's fees and mitigation be affirmed, but the court, we are here over a document that can't be a contract because it wasn't agreed to in the same sense by both parties.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. Mr. Grand, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, I think before I get into my response, I'd like to address some of the comments made by Coldstone's counsel on a couple of those issues. First of all, it was the proof issue. I had taken the deposition in Arizona of Jill Silberberg, which was the only witness that came up from Coldstone, and I'd learned in her, and it came out at trial that she wasn't hired by Coldstone until after the default occurred. I mean, it was long after this contract was formed. It was long after any of the factual evidence regarding the formation of the contract could ever be known by her or any testimony could be given by her. And that was my principal objection with Judge Caldwell, with Ms. Silberberg testifying anything with respect to the intent of the contracting parties. Now, with respect to the one document that did come in with 18, and it had, there's an entry for 18 months on it, the problem I had with that was, and I think Judge Caldwell agreed, is that there was no foundation laid for when that 18-month little, first of all, there was no testimony as to what it meant because Jill Silberberg wasn't there. She couldn't give that testimony. And second, there was no foundation laid for when the 18 months might have been written in. It was admitted that it could have been written in after the trial, or after the litigation started for anybody new. So I think the judge correctly said, it's a court trial. The court let the document in, but I think the court correctly noted towards the end, of the whole procedure in her order that really any meaning that can be attributed to that comment is meaningless from an intent sense because there was no foundation laid for it. You don't know when it was put on the document, and the witness could not give any of that evidence. That was the only evidence with respect to intent that came from Cold Springs that Coldstone is that one document. So that left us not with parties that didn't have a meeting of the minds. What it left us with was a lease with two ambiguous provisions in it. And under the Heine case, South Dakota case cited in our brief, that means that the court can properly accept parole and extrinsic evidence of the parties to determine what that meant, and that's exactly what did happen. And the only witness who testified as to the intent of the parties, the witness from Arrowhead, testified that in detail that the contract was intended to be a 10-year contract, not an 18-month contract, and that's why I spent about half of my first time explaining how that clause or those two clauses came to be. And Arrowhead would disagree that that's a landlord issue, but that Coldstone took the last draft that was out there, executed, and sent it back with the intent to be bound by 10 years. Also in evidence was Cold Stone sublease with its franchisee that did come into evidence. So if they didn't intend to do a 10-year lease, why did they do a lease with their franchisee for a similar period? So I don't think that, I think there's evidence which actually controverts that. I'd like to get to the meeting of the minds argument brought up by counsel. Counsel cites the Vanderheide case, and I should say Cold Stone cites the Vanderheide case and the Reed v. McKinnon case for the proposition that there was no meeting of the minds in this case. Well, first of all, Vanderheide says that, and Reed start their analysis by saying whether there's a mutual assent is a fact question determined by the words and the actions of the parties. So it starts its analysis to determine whether there's a meeting of the minds by the words and actions of the parties. And the words and the actions of the parties were only, the only evidence of that came through Arrowhead's witness, which supports Arrowhead's argument. So in the first instance, you look to that. What counsel, or what Cold Stone attempted to do throughout its entire arguments, and I'll get into the other arguments with respect to unilateral mistake and fraud, was that it attempted to go right from an ambiguity to a rule of construction. Well, if you don't have any evidence in, I mean, if you didn't bring a witness to the trial that could testify as to the end of the intent, about the only thing you're left to argue is a rule of construction. But as the Vanderhitty case and the cases with respect to mutual assent show, it's really the intent of the parties that is a more critical evidence. And if you actually look at these cases, the Vanderhitty case and the other two cases that were cited, which were the Nelson case and the Knutson case, those were oral contracts. The Reed v. McKinnon case, which was mentioned by counsel, was an implied contract case. In none of those cases was there a written contract. In Vanderheide, the parties, there was a lot of testimony as to what the contract was in Vanderheide, but both parties couldn't remember or had told totally divergent stories on what that real estate lease was in the year 2000. In Reed v. McKinnon, the clinic that he mentioned alleged and tried to establish an implied contract, but the hospital came back and said, hey, we sent you a letter that says we don't want a contract with you. And in the Reed v. McKinnon case, the court says, no, there was no meeting of the minds on that, but that was pretty clear. In the Nelson case, which is the other case he cited for that proposition, I'll just quote the court. Not one of the testifying witnesses provided consistent testimony concerning any of the leasing, the terms of the leasing arrangement. So that's not the case we have here. We have strong testimony of what the intent of the parties was, and we have a written lease. And finally, the Knutson case, which is the final case cited by counsel with respect to this mutual assent argument, was the stepson case, where the stepson asked the stepmom, a mother, if she could lease her 40 acres. The stepmother said yes, and the stepmother's a lawyer asked the stepson, well, did you discuss the terms of that contract? And the answer was no, we didn't. And the court held the other way. Those cases aren't even close to the facts in this case, where we have a written lease, where the ambiguities were explained with properly admitted testimony by one of the parties to that contract, Arrowhead. Counsel also raises the a defense of unilateral mistake of a material fact to throw out this to attempt to throw out this contract. The case cited there is the Vermilia case, the BDL, which was the cost cutter fraud case, where the court actually found that a fraud was committed upon the tenant in the lease negotiation. But what's important about the Vermilia case is that the standard was set for proving a unilateral mistake of material fact at the clear and convincing evidence standard. The court found that if you're going to maintain a defense for unilateral mistake of material fact, you have to show that with clear and convincing evidence of fraud or mistake. And that just wasn't done here when Cold Stone didn't even bring a witness to the trial to explain that mistake. There was no testimony or no evidence by Cold Stone credible evidence that a mistake was even made. So it doesn't meet the standard by the very case that was cited by Cold Stone for unilateral mistake of a material fact. Um, Later on in its brief, Coldstone goes on and claims that, you know, you got these two interest provisions in here. One says X, the other one says Y. They're ambiguous. They got to be construed against the drafter. Well, that's a rule of construction again. And yes, normally it should be. That is a rule of construction. When you can't otherwise determine the intent of the parties, you can resort to these rules of construction. They're not great, but you can do it. Well, the case cited for that by counsel is the Bunkers case. And if you read the Bunkers case, again, the court starts out with an analysis. Before it gets to the rule of construction, the Bunkers case starts an analysis by saying intent is what is sought by this court of what the party's intent was at the time. And so the court starts out its analysis by saying we're trying to get to what the intent was on these two interest provisions. Apparently in the Bunkers case it couldn't do that with the extrinsic or parole evidence that the Heine case would allow and an ambiguity, and they had to resort to a rule of construction. And I can understand why Coldstone might argue that if you don't have a witness at trial. So, but that's not what Heine says. Heine says you get to the intent. Now, both parties admit that the two interest provisions make that this contract at least ambiguous with respect to that provision. Heine gets you to extrinsic and parole evidence, which Arrowhead brought to the trial and put before the court, and the court ruled on the only evidence that it had in front of it. So I don't think that argument works with respect to that also. So, Your Honor, that concludes my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Graham. That will be in recess until tomorrow morning, 9 a.m.